This is Audible.
The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock by Imogen Hermes Gower. Read by Juliet Stevenson. Volume 1. Chapter 1. September 1785. Jonah Hancock's counting house is built wedge-shaped and coffered like a ship's cabin, whitewashed walls and black skirting, beam pegged snugly to beam. The wind sings down Union Street, raindrops burst against the window pane, and Mr. Hancock leans forward on his elbows, cradling his brow in his hands. Rasping his fingers over his scalp, he discovers a crest of coarse hair the barber has missed, and idles over it with mild curiosity, but no irritation. In private, Mr. Hancock is not much concerned with his appearance. In society, he wears a wig. He is a portly gentleman of 45, dressed in worsted and fustian and linen, honest, familiar textures to match his threadbare scalp, the silverish fuzz of his jowls, the scuffed and stained skin of his fingertips. He is not a handsome man, nor ever was one, and as he perches on his stool, his great belly and skinny legs give him the look of a rat up a post. But his meaty face is amiable, and his small eyes with their pale lashes are clear and trusting. He is a man well designed for his station in the world, a merchant's son of a merchant's son, a son of Deptford, whose place is not to express surprise or delight at the rare things that pass through his rough hands, but only to assess their worth, scratch down their names and numbers, and send them on to the bright and exuberant city across the river. The ships he sends out into the world, the Eagle, the Calliope, the Lorenzo, cross and recross the globe. But Jonah Hancock himself, the stillest of men, falls asleep each night in the room in which he first drew breath. The light in the office has a murky cast to it, full of storms. The rain comes down in sheets. Mr. Hancock's ledgers are spread out before him, creeping with insect words and figures. But his mind is not on his work, and he is grateful for the distraction of a scuffling outside the office. "Ah," thinks Mr. Hancock, "that will be Henry." But when he turns around from his desk, it is only the cat. She is almost upside down at the foot of the stairs, with her rear in the air, her hind paws splayed wide on the bottom step, and her forepaws pinning a squirming mouse to the hall floorboards. Her little mouth is open, teeth flashing in triumph, but her position is precarious. To right herself, he calculates, she must let go of her quarry. "Whisht," says Mr. Hancock. "Begone." But she catches the mouse up in her jaws and prances across the hall. She is out of his sight, but he hears the thrum of her dancing paws and the dampish thud of the mouse's body hitting the floorboards as she flips it into the air again and again. He has watched her play this game many times, and always finds her inquiring, open-throated cry unpleasantly human. He turns back to his desk, shaking his head. He could have sworn it was Henry coming down the stairs. In his mind's eye, the scene has already taken place. His tall, thin son, with white stockings and brown curls, pausing to grin into the office, while all about him the dust motes sparkle. Such visions do not come to him very often, but when they do, they always disturb him, for Henry Hancock died at birth. Mr. Hancock is not a whimsical man, but he has never been able to shake the notion that the moment his wife laid her head back on her child-bed pillow and sighed her last wretched breath, his life diverged from its proper course. It seems to him that the one he ought to have had continues very nearby, with only a thin bit of air and chance separating him from it. And every now and then he catches a glimpse of it, as if a curtain has momentarily fluttered aside. In the first year of his viduity, for example, he once felt a warm human pressure against his knee during a card game. and looked down in fond expectation of a stout little child hauling itself to its feet beside his chair. Why was he so appalled to discover instead the left hand of Moll Rennie creeping along his thigh? On another occasion, a brightly painted toy drum caught his eye at a fair, and he had carried it nearly halfway home before he remembered that no small boy was there to receive it. 15 years have now passed, but in rare, unguarded moments, Mr. Hancock might hear a voice carried in from the street, or feel some tugging at his clothes, and his immediate thought is, Henry, as if he had had a son all along. He is never visited by his wife Mary in this way, although she was a great blessing to him. She was 33 when she died, a placid woman who had seen much of this world and was amply prepared for the next. Mr. Hancock does not doubt where she has gone, or the possibility that he might one day join her there, and for him this is enough. He only mourns their child, who passed so swiftly from birth to death, exchanging one oblivion for another, like a sleeper rolling over. From upstairs comes the voice of his sister, Hester Lippard, who visits every first Thursday to fossick through his larder and laundry and linen press, and exclaim at what she discovers there. A wifeless brother is a troublesome inheritance, but one by which her children may one day profit. If Mrs. Lippard does him the charity of removing her youngest from school to serve as his housekeeper, it is in reasonable expectation of reward. "Now, you see, the sheets have taken mildew," she's saying. "If you had stored them, as I advised you, did you note it all in your pocketbook?" The faintest of mumbles in response. "Well, did you? This is not for my benefit, Susanna, but for your own." A silence, in which he pictures poor Suki with her head hanging, her cheeks livid. "I declare, you make more trouble than you save me. So where's your red thread? Where? It's lost again. And who will pay for more, do you think?" He sighs and scratches. Where is the fruitful family to fill the rooms of this house, which his grandfather built and his father made fine? The dead are here, without a doubt. He feels their touch everywhere in its pitched floorboards and staircase spine, and in the voices of the church bells, St. Paul's at the front door, St. Nicholas's at the back. The hands of the shipwrights are alive here in the long curves of its beams, which recall the bellies of great ships, its lintels carved with birds and flowers, angels and swords, testament for ever to the labour and visions of men long dead. There are no children here to marvel in their turn at the skill of Deptford woodcarvers, unmatched in all the world, nor to grow up to the rhythm of ships leaving the docks gleaming and laden, returning battered and ragged. Jonah Hancock's children would know, as Jonah Hancock knows, what it is to load one's faith and fortune on board a ship and push it off into the unknown. They would know how a man who awaits a ship, as Mr. Hancock now does, is distracted by day and wakeful by night, prone to fidgeting, with a bitter taste rising in the back of his throat. He is snappish with his family, or else overly sentimental. He hunches over his desk, scratching out the same calculations over and over again. He bites his nails. What knowledge is all this, if it dies with Jonah Hancock? What good his joys and sorrows, if there is nobody to share in them? What purpose to his face and voice, if they are only to be assigned to dust? What value to his fortune, if it withers on the vine with no sons to pluck it down? And yet, sometimes, there is something more. All voyages start the same, when men in coffee houses gather about and scratch their chins and weigh risk against obligation. "I'll go in on that," says one.
"And I."
"And I."
For in this world there is no achieving anything all alone. Cast in thy lot and share the purse. And this is why a prudent man, does no business with drunks, with rakes, with gamblers, with thieves, or anybody with whom God might have cause to deal severely. You cast in your lot, and you share his sin. And it is so easy for a little craft to be dashed against the rocks, so easy for cargo to settle 5 fathoms deep in the dark. Sailors' lungs may brine, and their fingers may pickle. All that protects them is God's cupped hand. What does God say to Mr. Hancock? Where is the Calliope, whose captain has sent no word in 18 months? The summer trails away. Every day the mercury drops. If she does not return soon, she will not return, and the blame may well lie with him. What has he done that might demand such punishment? Who will throw in their lot with his if they suspect him ill-favoured? Somewhere a tide is turning. In that place where no land can be seen, where horizon to horizon is spanned by shifting, twinkling, faithless water, a wave humps its back and turns over with a sigh and sends its salted whispering to Mr. Hancock's ear. This voyage is special, the whisper says, a strange fluttering in his heart. It will change everything. And all of a sudden, in his silent counting house, this faded man, with his brow cupped in his hands, is gripped by a great childish glee of anticipation. The rain eases, the cat crunches on the skull of the mouse, and as she slaps her tongue about her muzzle, Mr. Hancock permits himself to hope. Chapter 2. Owing to the rain, it is unlikely that many birds are abroad, but perhaps a crow has just crept from the rafters of Mr. Hancock's house and now fans out its bombazine feathers and tips its head to one side to view the world with one pale and peevish eye. This crow, if it spreads its wings, will find them full of the still damp breeze gusting up from the streets below. Hot tar, river mud, the ammoniac reek of the tannery. And if it hops from its ledge and rises above the rooftops of Union Street, it will come first and swiftly to the docks, the cradles of ships to be, which even in their infancy rear above all the buildings. Some, polished and tarred, flags aflutter and figurehead winking, strain to be launched. Others, mere ribs of fresh-stripped wood with only air between them, lie in a dry dock, vast and pale, and naked as the skeletons of whales. If, from here, this crow steers itself northwest, following the turn of the river, and if it flies for 6 miles without pause, well, is this likely for a crow? What are their habits? What is the range of their territory? If it were to do this, coasting across the sky as the clouds recede, it would approach the city of London, the river crenellated on each bank with docks large and small, some built tall from yellow stone, some of sagging black wood. The wharves and bridges pen the water in tight, but after the storm it squirms and heaves. The white-sailed ships strain upon it, and the watermen have gathered their bravado to steer their little crafts away from the bank and race across the current. As the sun creeps out, this conjectured crow will fly over the winking glass of the Southwark melon farms, the customs house, the tiered spire of St. Bride's, the milling square of Seven Dials, and eventually come upon Soho. As it alights on a Dean Street gutter, its shadow will briefly cross the first floor window of one particular house, stealing the daylight from the room within so that the face of Angelica Neal is momentarily lost in darkness. She sits at her dressing table as cool and fragrant as a rosewater custard, picking at a bowl of hothouse fruit while her friend, Mrs. Eliza Frost, tweaks the last scorched curl paper from her hair. She has been laced back into her stays and half draped in a powdering robe. But there is a flush of the bedroom in her cheeks, and her eyes are dragged irresistibly back to her own dimpling reflection, as if to the face of a lover. A canary skips and whistles in its cage. Mirrors twinkle all about, and her table is strewn with ribbons and earrings and tiny glass bottles. Each afternoon, they carry it from the dark dressing room into the sunny parlour so as to spare their candles. "But these measures will soon be unnecessary," says Angelica, as a little storm of hair powder flies up around her. "When the season begins, and there are more places to be seen, more people to see me, our living will be far easier." On the floor, the crushed triangles of curl paper are dense with Wesleyan homily, snipped as they are from pious tracts passed out daily to the whores of Dean Street. "Humph," says Mrs. Frost, who now clutches a hank of her friend's yellow hair and is busy teasing it all into a great soft heap on top of her head. She has to remove the pins nipped between her lips before she can reply properly.
"I hope you're right."
They have been in these rooms for a fortnight, paying with notes peeled off a wedge which, although jealously protected by Mrs. Frost, is swiftly diminishing.
"How you do worry," says Angelica.
"I don't like it. Money coming in spits and spots, not knowing one day to the next."
"'Tis not my fault."
Angelica opens her eyes very wide. Her chemise slips an inch down her bosom. It is not Angelica's fault. Until a month previous, she was in the keeping of a middle-aged duke, who doted upon her for the 3 years they lived together, but in his will forgot her.
"And you reduced to letting any man make free with you?" says Mrs. Frost.
The sunlight flashes off the back of the brush. Mrs. Frost is tall and narrow, the skin of her face unpainted and very smooth and taut, like kid's skin. It is difficult to age her, for her person is like her dress, neat and plain, sponged lightly clean each night, kept carefully from the world.
"Any man who can afford it, which keeps the numbers down. Listen, my dove, I do know your opinion, but since I pay your way, I am not obliged to hear it."
"You're compromising yourself."
"How else am I to keep us in stockings? You answer me that, you who are so conscientious in your bookkeeping. And don't you draw in your breath, for I know what you will say. You would lecture me on my extravagance. But no man hands banknotes to a drab who looks as if sixpence would content her. I have my appearance to consider."
"You have nothing to do with the accounts," said Mrs. Frost. "You cannot imagine how this complicates my life."
A little flash of electricity whisks through Angelica's body. She grips the arms of her chair and stamps her feet on the floorboards so the curl papers leap, reanimated, and scratch their printed wings together.
"My life is very complicated, Eliza."
"Keep your temper."
Another vigorous burst of powder.
"Leave off!"
Angelica swats her hands about her head.
"You will cover up all its colour."
Angelica is protective of her heavy gold hair, for it was once the making of her. In her tenderest youth, she found herself assistant and model to an Italian hairdresser, and, according to legend, it was from him that little fat Angelica learned not only the art of grooming, but also the art of love. The women are silent. At moments of impasse, they know better than to talk it out. They retreat resentfully back into their own heads as pugilists to their corners. Mrs. Frost shakes an armful of paper into the fire, and Angelica turns back to the fruit bowl, popping grapes off their stems one by one, gathering them into her fist. She licks their juice off the heel of her hand. The sunlight slanting through the window is warm on the down of her cheek. She is 27 and still beautiful, which owes something to luck and something to circumstance and something to good sense. Her bright blue eyes and voluptuous smile are gifts of nature. Her body and mind are unmarked by the toils she might have known as a wife. Her skin is clear, her grot fragrant, and her nose still whole, thanks to the little pouches of sheep gut she keeps in her cabinet, tied with green ribbons and carefully rinsed after each use.
"Dying was the best thing he could have done," she says to Mrs. Frost as a peace offering. "And just in time for the season."
Her companion remains silent. Angelica is not to be deterred.
"I am entirely independent now."
"That is what troubles me."
Mrs. Frost is tight-lipped still, but she advances again on Angelica's hair.
"What fun I shall have, indebted to nobody."
"Supported by nobody."
"Oh, Eliza."
Angelica can feel her friend's cool fingers upon her scalp. She pulls free and twists in the chair to look up into her face.
3 years I've seen nobody. No society, no parties, no fun. Kept in a dull little parlour."
"He kept you very generously."
"And I am not ungrateful. But I made sacrifices, you know. That artist who put my picture in the Academy, he would have painted me 100 times if the Duke had not forbidden him. May I not now enjoy a little wildness?"
"Hold still, or I shall never be done."
Angelica leans back in her chair.
"I have been in more precarious positions than this. I have been all alone in the world since I was only 14.
"Yes, yes."
Mrs. Frost, before she was Mrs. Frost, had swept the grates at Mrs. Elizabeth Chapel's celebrated Temple of Venus, while Angelica Neal, before she was Angelica Neal, danced naked.
"Well, don't it follow? If one man can settle on me, so will others. But now is the time to be out in society. I must place myself in the right circles, show my face everywhere until it is well known again. For really that is what is vital. None of the very great courtesans are especially beautiful, you know, or not many of them. I am beautiful, am I not?"
"You are."
"Well then," Angelica says, "I will be a success."
She sinks her teeth into a peach and sits back to watch her reflection chew and swallow.
"I only wonder."
"I do believe that men find me more attractive than ever." Angelica plunges on. "I need not be a mercenary, fawning over anybody who will have me. I am in a position to make my own choice."
"But will you not?"
"I think the blue ribbon for my hair."
Outside on the street there is a great commotion. Bouncing along the cobbles comes a sky-blue landau, emblazoned on each side with a bare-breasted golden sphinx. Angelica jumps up.
"She's here! Take off your apron! No, put it back on! I won't have you mistaken for one of the party."
She flies to the window, divesting herself of her powdering robe's smocky folds as she goes. The sun is sinking, infusing the street below with a honeyish haze. In the landau, amongst a clutch of young ladies in white muslin, rides Mrs. Chapel herself, the abbess of King's Place. She is built like an armchair, more upholstered than clothed, her bolster of a bosom heaving beneath cream taffeta and gold frogging. When the landau comes to a halt, she staggers to her feet, arms outspread and rings a twinkle. 2 negroes in sky-blue livery hop from the footplates to help her descend.
"New servants again, poor dupes," says Angelica,
watching them each taking an elbow while the girls heave at the swags adorning her vast rump.
"They don't know yet that she pays them half what they are worth."
The landau is remarkably well sprung, and Mrs. Chapel lurches onto the cobbles in a flash of starched lace. Several tiny dogs scamper forth, the girls spill after them, and all together they caper in the street, a festival of plumed tails and plumed hats, as Mrs. Chapel staggers in her footman's grip. can he offer to employ those blacks so lately arrived from America that they mistake their own value? Imagine, Eliza, delivered from bondage to her employ. These shining visitors to Dean Street do not go unmarked. A washerwoman with a bundle on her back hisses through her teeth, but her apprentice, hair scraped up under her cap, stands stock still and stares. Four boys set up a whooping, and men raise their hats or lean on the handles of their barrows and grin. The girls dimple smugly, swishing their skirts this way and that, their fans in constant motion, then incline their necks and turn out the white skin of their forearms. Angelica hauls the window open and leans out, shading her eyes with one hand.
"My dear Mrs. Chapel," she calls,
which sets the girls off fluttering ever more vigorously and turns all heads up to the window. The sun blazes in Angelica's hair.
"How kind of you to visit me."
"Polly," barks Mrs. Chapel. "Kitty, Eleanor."
And the girls stand to attention, fans waving, bright-eyed.
"Eliza," hisses Angelica, "we must move this table."
Mrs. Frost starts heaping ribbons and jewels upon it.
"A flying visit,"
calls Mrs. Chapel, pressing her hand to her bosom with the effort of projection.
"Come up, come up,"
cries Angelica, the attention of Dean Street pinned upon her.
"Have a saucer of tea."
She pulls back from the window.
"Christ, Eliza, have we any tea?"
Mrs. Frost whips from her bosom a twist of pink paper.
"We always have tea."
"Oh, you are an angel, a darling. What would I do without you?"
Angelica seizes one end of the table, Mrs. Frost the other, and thusly they bear it between them, shuffling as if they were hobbled so as not to dislodge its slew of trinkets. The fruits in the bowl bounce and tremble, and the mirror rattles on its stand.
"You know what she is come for,"
Angelica pants.
"And are we in accord?"
"I've made my opinion plain."
Mrs. Frost attempts primness, but she is trotting backwards while carrying a laden table and must keep flicking glances over her shoulder to avoid reversing into the wall.
"Give me time and I will set your mind at ease."
In the dressing room, they manoeuvre the table around Mrs. Frost's hard little cot.
"Hurry, hurry, put it anywhere. We shall have time to straighten up when they've gone. Now run, run and let them in. Remember to wipe the saucers before you pass them around. Maria dusts like a slut."
Mrs. Frost vanishes swift as a will-o'-the-wisp, but Angelica lingers in the gloomy dressing room, pondering herself in the mirror. From a distance, she looks well, small and elegant, and she goes closer, pressing her palm against the tabletop to lean in. The glass is cold, and her breath makes a little fog, which blooms and shrinks across her reflection. She watches her pupils expand and contract, studies the edges of her lips, which are chafed pink from the business of the afternoon. The skin around her eyes is as white and unlined as the inside of an eggshell, but she has a tiny crease in each cheek, like the indent of a fingernail, and one between her eyebrows which deepens when she frowns at it. She can hear the girls giggling in the corridor downstairs, and Mrs. Chapel's admonishments.
"What giddiness! Such unruliness in the street! Did I teach you to behave in such a way?"
"No, Mrs. Chapel."
Angelica cracks her knuckles. She goes back into the parlour and chooses a chair to recline on, spreading her skirts out carefully.
"And will you be proud of yourselves when some clever soul puts it into print? When it's written up in town and country that Mrs. Chapel's nuns, the cream of England's girlhood, play leapfrog in the street like a mob of brewers' daughters? Well, I never. Well, I never. Come now, I must lean on you. These stairs are beyond my powers today."
Breathing stertorously, she enters Angelica's apartment, supported by the red-headed Eleanor Bewley.
"Oh, dear Mrs. Chapel," Angelica cries. "So glad, so pleased. What a pleasure to see you."
This is by no means untrue. Mrs. Chapel is as near a thing to a parent as Angelica knows, and it should not be supposed that their line of trade diminishes their affection. Boards are not, after all, the only mothers to profit by their daughters.
"Sit me down, girls. Sit me down," snorts Mrs. Chapel,
and she labours towards a tiny japanned chair, with Angelica and Miss Bewley clutching at her arms like girls struggling with a marquee in a high wind.
"Not that one,"
gasps Mrs. Frost, her eyes darting in horror between the chair's spindly legs and Mrs. Chapel's bulk.
"Over here,"
squeaks dark-eyed Polly, the quadroon, dragging an armchair from the corner and sliding it into Mrs. Chapel's path at the last possible moment. The board, although sizable, enhances her natural bulk with a vast cork bum beneath her petticoats, which emits a cloud of dust and a hollow thud as it hits the seat. She subsides with a long wheeze. Winded, she flaps her hands at her left foot, and Polly lifts it gently to rest on a stool.
"My dear,"
huffs Mrs. Chapel when she has found her breath. Her lips are mauve.
"My Angelica, we just returned from Bath. I can't stay short. I had to satisfy myself that you were well settled. I did not sleep for worrying. Is that not so, girls? You cannot imagine my distress at the lodgings I heard you took."
"For a very brief time," objects Angelica. "There was a financial misunderstanding."
She glances over at the girls, who perch together on the sofa, watching the conversation with their heads cocked. Their skin is free from blemish, and their little bodies neat as mannequins beneath their spotless Perdita gowns, delivered from nakedness by a whisper of white muslin and the slenderest of drawstrings.
"I have not introduced you to my kitty," says Mrs. Chapel.
She stretches out her hands to the smallest of the girls.
"Stand up, you."
Kitty makes a studied curtsy. She is a spindly, dazed-looking creature with a long neck and large pale eyes, greyish like the rim on skimmed milk, her eyebrows dabbed on a shade too dark.
"Thin,"
says Angelica.
"But an elegant frame," says Mrs. Chapel. "We're feeding her up. I found her down at Billingsgate, covered in fish scales and reeking like low tide. Ain't that right, girl? Turn around, then. Let Mrs. Neal look at you."
The girl's skirt makes a hushing sound. The scent of pettigrain rises up from its folds. She moves slowly and carefully. In the corner, Mrs. Frost pours the tea, a musical arc, and Polly and Eleanor pass out the bowls as their abbess talks in laboured snatches. She breathes as if she were singing an opera, exhaling through each phrase before sucking in another desperate lungful and plunging onwards.
"They told me she'd had smallpox. Very small pox indeed, says I. There's not a mark on her. Quality, this one. See how she holds herself. I did not teach her that. 'Tis her natural bearing. Show her your ankles, Kitty."
Kitty lifts her hem. Her feet are small and narrow, in little silver slippers.
"Does she speak?"
asks Angelica.
"That is our next task,"
grunts Mrs. Chapel.
"She's a mouth like low tide, too. She'll not open it again until I give her leave."
They fall quiet in their assessment of the child, or at least they leave off speaking, for Mrs. Chapel wheezes like a set of bagpipes, even in repose.
"She will be a deal of work," remarks Angelica.
"I like them this way. The middling girls are the ones that's caused me trouble. Been sent off to a dame school. taught the pianoforte. Got their own ideas about what delicate manners are. Give me street urchin over tradesman's daughter every time. Save me undoing somebody else's work.
I was a tradesman's daughter.
And look at you. Not one thing nor another. You chase every fancy that comes upon you. I can hardly bear to discover what has become of you from one week to the next. If you're set to be married, or run in a few good visitors. Or you're reduced to a streetwalker.
She's breathless for a moment, fixing Angelica sternly with a pouchy wet eye.
Which is not what I trained you for.
I never did such a thing,
protests Angelica.
I hear what I hear.
I may on occasion have happened to walk in the street, but which of us has not been driven to that?
Not my girls. Do you consider how your reputation reflects on mine?
She clears her throat and moves on to business.
Here, Mrs. Neil, I know that your misfortune is through no fault of your own, and that you are thought well of by many of our best gentlemen. Ever since your bereavement, they've been asking after you. Where's our favourite little blonde, they say? Where is our dear playmate with the beautiful voice? What can I tell them?
She presses Angelica's hand to her creped bosom.
You can tell them my address, says Angelica. You see that I am well set up here, and so near the square. 'Tis terrible genteel.
Oh, Angelica, but you all alone. It grieves my heart to see you unprotected. My dear girl, we have room for you in the nunnery. We will always have room. Will you not consider returning to us?
The girls, Polly, Eleanor and Kitty, have been exposed to a level of training more rigorous and exclusive than near any in the world. But when they feel themselves free from scrutiny, they retreat into childhood. And now they bounce gently on the sofa, buoyed by one another's fidgeting. They're impressed by Angelica's glamour, and want her as an elder sister to sing duets with them and teach them new ways with their hair. Late at night, when the men are at last stupefied, perhaps she would pass out cups of chocolate and tell tales of her own scandalous girlhood. They watch as Mrs. Chapel leans forward to put a hand on Angelica's.
It would be a weight off my mind to have you under my roof once more.
And a weight in your purse to advertise my services,
Angelica says, smiling her finest. Mrs. Chapel is an expert in frank conversation, but usually on her own terms.
Certainly not,
she splutters.
Certainly, that is not my first concern. And what of it? 'Tis protection I offer you, first and foremost. Think of it, dear. A dedicated physician, a steady flow of the right sort of men. The wrong sort gain no admission, no bills, no bailiffs.
She is watching Angelica carefully, intent as a she-cat at hunt.
It is a dangerous city we live in.
She pats Angelica's hand once more and continues jovially.
And when you find a new protector, well, say no more. You will be released from my service in a moment.
In the corner, Mrs. Frost's face is a picture of desperation. She is trying to catch Angelica's eye, but Angelica cannot look at her. She thinks,
I am not so young as these girls. I have only a few seasons left to show myself at my best.
At length, she says,
I knew you would ask me back. And, madam, I am grateful for your remembrance of me. You are a true friend.
I mean only to help you, my pet.
Angelica swallows. Then may I direct your help to where it is most needed? This is a request not many mothers are receptive to. Mrs. Chapel hems.
As a prudent businesswoman, says Angelica, I trust you have carefully considered where my value lies. Is it in my continued presence in your house? Or is it in my rising in the world?
She pauses. She watches the pulse quivering in Mrs. Chapel's jowls. The girls look on, complacently fed and clothed. Mrs. Frost has taken her seat on the little stool by the door. Now Angelica sees her press her hand to her bosom, in fact to the hidden pocket in her stomacher where she keeps her dwindling pad of banknotes.
"I propose a middle way," she says.
Nobody speaks. The next leap is a great one for her, but she waits 3-4 seconds before continuing slowly.
"I mean to trade on my own bottom. 'Tis the right moment for me. Surely you see that?"
Mrs. Chapel considers. Her tongue, surprisingly pink, surprisingly wet, flicks briefly across her grey lips. She says nothing.
"As a friend," Angelica continues, "I will do you the favour of appearing at your house. You may have it known that you can send a chair for me any time it pleases the company, but in return I want my liberty. I trust that the next few years of my life may be very fruitful. I have proved myself a good mistress, and for the right gentleman I can be so again, if I am free to receive him."
"You think you're able to make your way alone?"
"Not all alone. Madam, I shall need your help. But you launched me in this world. Would you not have me press on? And to what would I owe my success, if not your methods?"
The abbess's smile is slow in coming, but when it does, she fairly beams. Her gums are pale and expansive, her teeth as yellow and oblong and all of a type as the keys of a harpsichord.
"I have trained you well," she crows. "You are no mere whore. You are a woman of substance, as I always hope my girls will be, as fine a little frigate as ever I launched on London town. Kitty, Eleanor, Polly, especially you, Polly, mark this. You have the opportunity to ascend, girls, and ascend you must. Ambition. Always ambition. No streetwalkers, mine."
Angelica's heart pounds under her stays. For a moment, the world swims around her. She has never dared talk back before. After Mrs. Chapel and her girls have left, waving and calling out endearments, she flings herself down on the sofa in jubilation.
"This proves it,"
she says to Mrs. Frost, who is clearing away the tea things in quick, jerky movements, her head down.
"She cannot afford to make an enemy of me. She gives me my way."
"You should not have rejected her,"
says Mrs. Frost. Her lips are tight, her words little.
"Eliza?"
Angelica sits up. She tries to peer into her friend's face, but she will have none.
"Oh, Eliza, you are angry with me."
"You might have considered our security,"
spits Mrs. Frost.
"We are secure.
Oh, we will be. If I did not believe so before, I do now. Mother Chapel has an instinct for success." She does not like her friend's brand of cold, tense rage. She rises and follows her across the room, beseeching.
"My dear, my dove, sit down here with me. Come, come."
She takes Mrs. Frost by the shoulders and tries to steer her to the couch, but she is rigid as a Dutch doll under her cotton and calamanco.
"I swear to you, I will keep us safe. We're on the up, you and I."
It is as if she is a ghost, her voice unheard, her touch unfelt. While Mrs. Frost ties her apron a little tighter around her waist, picks up the tray of the whore's leavings, and removes from the room.
"Oh, no, no," says Angelica. "Do not leave me in this manner. Have pity."
But she hears Mrs. Frost's steps retreating without so much as a pause, and reminds herself, "She will be enjoying this. I begging her.
What nonsense."
Out loud, she spits,
"Suit yourself,"
and then going to the head of the stairs, shouts down,
"You are a foolish, stubborn woman. Surely you are."
But Mrs. Frost is long gone. Chapter 3. In the evening, Mr. Hancock stays in by the fire with his niece Suki, as he has all week.
"Would you not go to an alehouse?"
asks Suki, and she can hardly be blamed, for he is not restful company. He cannot remain in his chair 3 minutes before rising, as if a wasp has crept under his seat, to pace the parlour, opening and closing boxes, whose contents he has made himself familiar with 5 times over already. He leans upon the mantel and opens a book, but its pages are gibberish to him, and he lays it down again. Twice he goes to stand on the landing, and has Bridget, the maid, hammer at the front door from without to satisfy him that no caller could possibly go unmarked.
"A few hours will not hurt,"
Suki pursues, thinking wistfully of her own plans for the evening, viz. To make free with his tea caddy and skim spoonfuls of cream off the milk basin in the larder.
"But if there is news of the Calliope, and they cannot find me?"
"I should like to meet the man who ever succeeded in hiding in this town."
He sits down, his chin on his fist. Then he stands up again.
"Perhaps I had done better to have remained in the city. In the coffee house, they will have the most reliable news."
"Uncle, what difference does it make?"
says Suki.
"If word comes tonight, what can be done before the morning?"
She is shrewd like her mother. She quirks her eyebrow in the same way.
"I will know," he says. "I cannot be easy until I know."
"And you are making certain that nobody else can be either. Sir, we may hear nothing for a good long time."
"No, it will be soon. I'm certain."
And yes, he is quite certain. Every nerve of his body hums like a strung viol. He advances upon the window and looks out onto the darkening street.
"Your ceaseless mooning,"
she exclaims, a phrase straight from her mother Hester's mouth, and his muscles go tight, for her white cap and pursed lips have melted 40 years from the room, as if she were his great sister and he a little boy. But Suki sparkles with mischief.
"Aren't I just playing?"
she says, and he is so relieved to breathe again that he lets out a guffaw.
"You saucy miss," he says. "What if I were to tell her how you ape her?"
"Then I might tell her of all the time you spend in taverns."
"You never would."
He acknowledges that it does him good to have a young person in his household. It gladdens him to hear her and Bridget's shrieks as they chase one another down the stairs, and to see them stroll out together on errands, arm in arm. He will even tolerate an apple-pie bed every now and then, for what else is to be expected of a girl of 14? In all other particulars, Suki is, after all, an excellent housekeeper, and infinitely preferable to the surly hirelings who came before her. If she were his own daughter, he would have had her cast her sharp little mind over his ledgers. But he must assume that what she knows, her mother must shortly know too. He has taken the precaution of buying her a fine silk day dress, and allowing her to wear it about the house, so that by its constant rustling, he will know her presence. Suki meanwhile, is secretly pleased to have been sent to her uncle. Of all the situations that might have called for a spare daughter, this is the best by far. She dreads the day her brother will get another child on his fat wife, and she, Suki, will be called to Erith to scrub the nursery and mop drool. Here she has her own room, and she and Bridget find themselves often at their leisure, for a modest old man makes little work.
"Will I read to you, then?" she sighs. "The evening will not pass itself."
"Very well. Pope's essays, if you please."
"Oh, yawn. Uncle, it don't please me even one bit. No, choose something else."
He sighs. "I think you have something in mind." Indeed, she wastes no time in whipping from behind her chair a handsome little volume of the sort sold all down Fleet Street.
"This is a good one,"
she says, bending close to the firelight to riffle through its pages.
"I am halfway through, so you will have to guess at what adventures came before."
So many novels, he wonders. Such a mob of Amelias and Matildas and Selinas. I had not thought the exploits of young ladies could take up so much print.
"I am addicted to them,"
she says happily. "I am not." But this is untruthful. He is a sentimentalist, and furthermore, he enjoys Suki's reading aloud. She has a high, bright voice and bobs her head with narrative energy.
"You will like this one, Uncle. 'Tis full of excitement and highly instructional."
"Your mother is right. I allow you too much pin money. Your library is larger than my own."
Mr. Hancock's books number 18 in total, excluding his Bible, which may be classified as an artifact. Then, because he enjoys her company more than he does Alexander Pope's, he says,
"Well, will you read it or no?"
She wriggles in her seat to get comfortable and clears her throat. This is the moment there comes a great thundering at the door. Mr. Hancock scrambles with his pipe, spilling tobacco over his shoes in his haste to rise.
"Sit down, Uncle,"
says Suki, who is on her feet too.
"It sounds important."
"Even so, 'tis not proper for a gentleman to answer his own front door. You want to hire a man,"
she says, and while he is stammering and grappling with the question of whether he is or is not a gentleman, and furthermore the cost of a liveried footman, and furthermore the absurdity of it, the hammering starts again.
"Don't go,"
Suki warns him, adding in her mother's voice,
"Bridget must see to it. That is what she is for."
But she cannot help kicking off her slippers and creeping across the room in her stockings. She nudges the door ajar with her toe and presses her face into the gap. She will have a clear view across the landing to the front door at the foot of the stairs.
"What do you see?"
he asks.
"Nothing,"
she says.
"Bridget,"
she hisses into the darkness. When the door sounds again, it is with a true pounding. The panels tremble, and the iron bars across the fanlight set up a high, resonant hum.
"Open up, sir,"
calls a voice from outside.
"'Tis Tizo Jones."
He himself? He's not sent a boy. "Confound it, something is amiss," says Mr. Hancock, and he barges past Suki and down the stairs. It is dark as doomsday, but he has run up and down these stairs since he first learned use of his feet, and there is a flutter of light behind him as his niece comes forth with a taper to light the sconces.
"He must not find our house unlit, and we sitting only with the fire,"
she is muttering. Mr. Hancock is down the stairs with a scuffle and a clatter, his lungs juddering in his chest as he repeats,
"Something is amiss. This is not the usual way of things,"
and thinks,
"What will we do now, if the ship is lost and the cargo with it? Oh, that will be a blow. Is it one he can absorb? And what of his investors? Many men stand to be disappointed on his initiative."
He's ticking over the figures in his head, even as he reaches the hall and comes to the front door.
God be praised, he thinks, for bricks and mortar. For if it comes to it, I may sell my tenanted houses. This one too. But God forbid that I be the one to sell my father's house.
He unlocks the door with palsied hands, the big key from his bunch first, followed by bolts top and bottom. The metal is heavy and uncooperative in his fingers. He wrenches once, twice at the top bolt that always sticks.
Oil, Suki! Fetch me oil for the door!
Until it shoots home too fast, nipping the side of his palm, so he curses. Outside, he can hear Captain Taizo Jones stamping and swearing on the step.
I'm here,
Mr. Hancock calls, clasping his injured hand. As he opens the door, there is a little crescendo of light as Suki puts the taper to the last of the candles, and here is Captain Taizo Jones, ruggedly lit. He is in his sea clothes still, a jacket so faded by salt and sun that it appears dove grey, except for wedges of its old blue preserved under the lapels and the cuffs. His person is equally stained and faded. His face brick-coloured and tough as the soles of feet, with white creases about his eyes and mouth. The stubble on his cheeks twinkles as if a light frost has settled there. He clutches a canvas sack and looks mightily irritated.
"No time like the present," he says.
"Forgive me. I could not... I was unable to...
Mr. Hancock gestures at the door helplessly.
"Let me come in. I've walked from Limehouse."
His arms are crooked up to his chest, and he holds the sack as one holds a sleeping infant.
"I wish to stand no longer."
"Did you come home on the Calliope?"
"No."
Captain Jones steps past him into the house.
"My letter... explained everything."
"I received no letter. I've had no word from you since you left London in January last. Nothing."
Captain Jones removes his hat. He holds his bundle easily. It is neither heavy nor cumbersome.
"Good evening, young lady,"
he says to Suki. Her curtsy is perfunctory. Not her most elegant, although she practices it often enough in the bubbled mirror that hangs above the fire. She has lost her composure and is dumb as a child, mouth firm shut and eyes wide.
"You must have tea," she says at last.
"Ale,"
says Mr. Hancock, feeling cruel for correcting her.
"And have Bridget bring out the blade of beef."
Suki scuttles into the kitchen, her head ducked. He thinks,
if the ship is lost, her father has lost the £500 he invested. What will Hester say?
He waves Captain Jones into the counting-house, remembering too late that the candles within are extinguished. He wishes to be a good host, but in the thick wadded darkness, the words burst from his mouth.
"Where is my ship?" "Hanged if I know. Might we have a little light?"
His hands tremble as he lights the candles on the great desk.
"And what of its cargo?"
"I took no cargo,"
says Captain Jones, seating himself with a long groan of relief.
"I sent you a letter."
But there has been no letter. He is stupefied within, and he must appear stupefied without. For Captain Jones prompts him.
"A letter? I sent it with the Rosalie, which departed Macau shortly after I arrived."
"The Rosalie was lost with all hands. I received no letter."
"Oh, and so you will not know."
They sit in silence. Captain Jones fills his pipe. Its feeble light magnifies his frown of concentration as he draws upon it, darkness creeping into every crease and wrinkle. There is the suck and smack of his lips on the pipe stem, and the tock of the clock, and the tiny creaks and ticks of the old wooden house easing itself into a more comfortable position. The canvas bag sits on Captain Jones's lap all the while.
"I sold your ship, sir," he says.
Mr. Hancock's innards seem to liquefy. Sweat cools his palms. He reminds himself,
"I trust this man. He is my agent. My fortunes are his. He will act only in my interest." "It was for good reason," Captain Jones says. "I found an extraordinary thing, but it costs more than I had. You always gave me leave to make whatever choices I see fit."
"Aye, within the bounds of sensible cargo. A bolt of fabric, some novelty to try in the market when one thing cannot be got, to substitute it with something of no greater risk. To have lost my ship, that is my income."
"And mine too."
Captain Jones is at his ease. He has had a long voyage to make himself comfortable with this new situation, and, besides, he has always had an eye for extravagances. He sits forward in his chair and starts to grin.
"But I assure you, we shall recoup it numberless times. You never saw the like of what I found for you. Nobody saw the like."
"What is it?"
He thinks, "some idiot thing I will not be able to sell. A kitten with two heads, or a new type of poison, or a set of obscene etchings that will put me in jail."
"Where is the girl? Have her come in here."
"Do not make a spectacle of this foolishness," he sighs.
"This spectacle wants witnesses. Bring in your entire household. Light all the lamps."
Mr. Hancock is too rattled to stand up for himself any further. He stumps out to the hall, but there is no need to shout out for Suki. She and Bridget, this one bleary with sleep, her cap askew, she must have nodded off in the scullery again, are hovering by the door already, the tray of ale set down on the floorboards to keep it from rattling. In the darkness, their faces are pale echoes of one another, two ovals turning to him in inquiry.
"You heard," he says. "Light the lamps."
"Yes, sir,"
says Bridget. He can hear the quiver in her voice. Excitement has made her breath knot up in her throat. The pewter mugs on the tray clink and splosh as she picks it up, but her steps on the floorboards make no noise.
"Put your shoes on," he says. "Anybody might think you had been eavesdropping."
He brings the tray in himself, and after scuffling for their slippers, the girls follow him. Captain Jones has put the bag on the desk. By the way the cloth falls, Mr. Hancock thinks there is no softness to the thing it conceals. "Light as a bird and small enough to carry in the crook of a man's arm, how can it be worth a tall ship and all its promised cargo?" Behind him, Mr. Hancock feels the girls shift closer together. For they are always touching, these girls, pressing against one another, as kittens do when their mother leaves them. He hears the tentative movement that will be Bridget closing her hand around Suki's elbow, and squares his shoulders. He is sorry that he has no kindly friend to touch his arm.
"On my voyages,"
says Captain Jones,
"I have seen many strange things. Things that you cannot begin to imagine, ladies. I have seen cows with necks as tall as trees. I've seen ordinary-sized Chinean women with feet no bigger than hot-cross buns. And I have..."
"Out with it,"
Mr. Hancock interrupts.
"Is it in the bag?"
asks Suki.
"You are a young lady of striking perspicacity,"
Captain Jones observes the faces of his audience and sighs.
"Very well. Let us get this over with. Perhaps once you see the marvel I have brought to you, you will be more enthusiastic